Good afternoon. Welcome to the Democracy Forum. This is the second program in our series this year to broadcast at this time on the third Friday of each month. We're featuring topics in Maine's participatory democracy, encouraging citizens to take an active role in government and politics. This program is a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. Our conversation today is about private equity and you. We want to talk about private equity. What is it? Does private equity contribute to wealth and income inequality? Does it erode confidence in shared services and institutions? Does it undermine faith in capitalism and democracy itself? Does it always work that way? Does private equity sometimes do good? Has private equity come to Maine? Which sectors? And how can Maine protect its people from some of the most predatory outcomes? This show is pre-recorded on February 18th. You may send your comments to news at weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. I'll be your host on the Democracy Forum. Let me introduce our guests. Brendan Ballew is a former federal prosecutor and special counsel for private equity at the U.S. Department of Justice. He's the author of the book, Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. Welcome, Brendan.
Thank you for having me.
The Honorable Tracy Geer. Tracy is a Maine State Representative from Kennebunkport. She's chair of the Legislature's Housing and Economic Development Committee. Welcome, Tracy.
Thank you, Anne. Happy to be here.
Chris Noble is the Policy Director at the Private Equity Stakeholder Project. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks so much, Anne.
And finally, Pat Schwibler is the Co-Director of Cooperative Development of the Cooperative Development Institute's New England Resident-Owned Communities Program. Welcome, Pat.
Thank you, Anne. Nice to be here today.
So let's get started, Brendan. I guess I'll put the big question to you first. What is private equity anyway?
It's a great question, and I think it's a helpful one to start this conversation. So private equity is, at core, a very simple idea, or the business model is very simple. Private equity firms take a little bit of their own money, some investor money, and a lot of borrowed money to buy up companies. They then try to make operational or financial changes to the business with the hope of selling it for a profit a few years later. So at core, it's a very simple idea, but for reasons that I'm sure we'll discuss, often that business model can lead to bad outcomes, not just for customers and for employees, but for the businesses themselves.
So is it always a flip strategy, like buy, fix up, sell?
Essentially, there are a handful of private equity firms that would have a true buy and hold model. But I think at that point, you might not call those a leveraged buyout, which is sort of the core private equity business model. For the most part, private equity firms are trying to flip their businesses 2, 3, 5, maybe 7 years in the future.
Do they sometimes actually increase value so that they legitimately make the business a more attractive proposition?
Yeah. Absolutely. So I want to be clear that not every private equity firm deal ends in tragedy. Many private equity deals ultimately work out perfectly fine for the company and for the stakeholders. The challenge that we've got is because of the legal and regulatory structure that surrounds the private equity business, private equity firms are often incentivized to essentially extract value from a business rather than try to focus on its long-term sustainability or long-term profitability. So it's not that every deal is going to end disastrously, but because of our legal incentives, oftentimes they end poorly.
Maybe you should talk a little bit about those legal incentives then.
Sure. So I've argued that there are three basic problems with the private equity business model. The first is that private equity firms are incentivized to hold companies just for a short period of time. We are just talking about 2, 3, 5 years. And that timeline changes your perspective on a business. If you're going to own a business for just a few years, you might not invest in infrastructure, in your customers, in your employees, in your brand. Rather, you're going to try to make rapid cuts to the business so that you can turn a quick profit. So that's one problem. The other is that private equity firms tend to buy up businesses using a lot of debt, you know, like we said at the outset. But the kind of magic trick of the private equity business model is that it's typically the company that's bought that's required to pay back the debt rather than the private equity firm itself. And so what that means is it's a little bit like getting to use somebody else's credit card. If things go well, great. If they go poorly, the private equity firm doesn't have a ton of financial exposure. And at the same time, private equity firms are able to extract a lot of fees from the businesses that they buy. And these fees oftentimes can make firms a lot of money, even if they hurt the long-term profitability of the business. And then the last thing, just to wrap up a long answer to your short question, private equity firms often are very good at insulating themselves from legal or financial consequences of their actions. And so what that means is private equity firms can often engage in risky cost-cutting strategies for businesses that may hurt, sometimes literally hurt people. But if things go wrong, the private equity firm itself rarely has a lot of legal exposure. And so you combine all of those things, and it means that private equity firms are often encouraged to take a short-term extractive strategy to the businesses they buy rather than a long-term investment one.
So, like, you would distinguish in this definition, let's say, private equity from venture capital. And venture capital is private money investing in businesses, but it's not private equity in the definition that you're using.
Exactly. And I should be clear, private equity doesn't have a strict legal definition. You know, private equity firms often engage in a lot more than just private equity, leverage buyouts. They might be engaged in infrastructure, insurance, or hedge fund work. Venture capital, by contrast, you know, firms tend to make, rather than buying up whole businesses with a lot of debt, tend to make smaller equity investments using their own or investor money. So there may be all sorts of problems associated with venture capital, but it's a slightly different set of problems.
Now, Chris, I see you nodding along, benefit of doing this on Zoom. So do you want to chime in here?
It sounds Brendan laid out everything that I wanted to say, you know, perfectly in terms of general, you know, private equity, what it is, differences. You know, in terms of the venture capital, private equity distinction, I really do think it's a set of, you know, expectations. You know, as Brendan's, you know, mentioned, it's not as large of a stake, right? It's not an ownership stake usually they take. And then, you know, you're not looking for a history of making a bunch of profit because, you know, oftentimes it's a startup or something. But we're still talking about private markets, right? And so, you know, I think the major point there is that they still operate in a world that has less regulation than public markets. You know, it is sort of difficult to truly get a sense of, you know, valuation sometimes. And so, you know, I just appreciated the distinction. There is a difference, but it's still within the same universe, I'd say.
And Chris, I mean, I know your firm, the Private Equity Stakeholder Project, is sort of in the business of trying to find out, you know, where these businesses are and where they're investing. How hard is it to find out?
Very difficult. You know, we try to use what we can, you know, databases. We utilize software to sort of scrape the internet for different deals and metrics. But yeah, I mean, they don't have to disclose as many of their books, right, as public companies do. And then when you're talking about also the portfolio company, for instance, one of the things that we push for at our organization is for instance, like a corporate landlord to have to, you know, be part of a rental registry or something, a database that will allow us to track the actual ownership of the sort of labyrinth of LLCs that corporations use to own property real estate companies. And so that's, yeah, it's tough.
You used a term there that I didn't understand. Portfolio company, what's that?
Sure. So going back to the definition of private equity, right? They pull money from other investors, usually pension funds, institutional investors, to then invest into what I just mentioned as portfolio companies. These are the companies that they end up, you know, creating funds, you know, to invest in. Depending on the sector, it could be, you know, real estate, what have you. But they cook up different strategies, possibly healthcare, and they come up with a group of companies to invest in, and those are the portfolio companies.
Oh, I see. So it's a portfolio of the companies that the fund has purchased. I see. Okay.
Exactly.
Brendan, back to you. Is this lack of transparency actually part of the problem?
Absolutely. Chris's organization, the Private Equity Stakeholder Project, has been doing enormously valuable research on exactly this issue. The secrecy is inherent in the name, private equity, as opposed to the public markets, where there are necessary disclosure obligations as a sort of consequence of being able to solicit money generally from the public. Private equity firms don't have those obligations, and there's been a concerted litigation effort to make sure that at a federal level, it's not possible to have those obligations. There's been a lot of litigation against the Securities and Exchange Commission's efforts to regulate the private equity and private funds industry generally.
Okay, so wait a minute. The litigation has been to keep it secret? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so there have been various efforts by the Securities and Exchange Commission to bring transparency to what they generally called the private funds markets. So increased disclosure about the holdings of private equity firms, hedge funds, and so forth. I haven't tracked the latest on that litigation, but the last I checked, and Chris should correct me if I'm wrong, that was enjoined in the Fifth Circuit, so the southern states, and prevented that from going into effect. To add a little bit of nuance to this, I should say, not every company should have the obligations of public business. It's a lot of obligation to be a public business. But once you have institutions as large as some of the largest private equity firms in the United States, Blackstone, for instance, has $1 trillion in assets under management. It seems like there's value in having greater transparency, both for potential investors, but also for regulators and the public at large in thinking about the systemic risks that such sort of concentration in the finance industry might pose.
You want to add to that, Chris, about the...
Yes, just to piggyback on that case that Brendan was talking about, that rule that the SEC promulgated was actually, it wasn't even a public disclosure. It was for investors. So, we're in a situation where the folks investing, again, which are many times, if not most of the time, public pension funds that don't have the same rights within an agreement, like within a partnership agreement, to look at the same information or get the same deals. They're often referred to as side letters, right? The thrust of it was to put those investors on more of an even playing field with each other, and also in relation to the private equity firm. So,
I think I read a few months ago about the Treasury Department sort of coming down on some money laundering thing or other to do with a private equity firm. Did I make that up, or you don't remember that?
I personally am not aware of it, but that's not to say that that such schemes weren't happening.
I guess that one of the questions that brought up in my mind had to do with foreign investors. And I don't really know what these sovereign funds are and stuff, but how does foreign money play into this?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, As Chris was mentioning, a lot of the money that private equity firms use in their investments come from pension funds, the pension funds of teachers and firefighters and so forth. The other sources tend to be endowments. So, University of Maine or Harvard or whoever it happens to be, and what are called sovereign wealth funds, which are the investment pools of large countries, or at least wealthy countries, that are trying to make a profit off of their cash holdings. So, for instance, there has been a great deal done to solicit the sovereign wealth funds of the Saudi government. Blackstone, for instance, I believe at one point at least got a $40 billion commitment from the Saudi sovereign wealth fund to invest in projects, at least some projects in the United States. I don't know if the Sovereign Wealth Fund was ultimately able to deliver on that commitment or not. There have been similar efforts to cultivate investment from and into China. And at one point back earlier in the 2010s, there was even an effort to start to cultivate investors from and into Russia. Now, that that effort ultimately fell apart. But all of which is to say that the private equity industry truly is an international business, both in where it's making its acquisitions and where it's getting its money from.
Anyone want to add anything to that? I'm going to take a quick station break. Okay, you're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our topic today is private equity and you. Our guests this afternoon are the Honorable Tracy Geer, Maine State Representative from Kennebunkport and Chair of the Legislature's Housing and Economic Development Committee, Chris Noble, who is Policy Director at the Private Equity Stakeholder Project, Pat Schwebler, who's co-director of the Cooperative Development Institute's New England Resident-Owned Communities Program, and Brendan Ballou, author of the book Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. This program was pre-recorded on February 18th. No listener calls are being taken. So how can we tell if this is coming to Maine? This is your thing, Chris. How are you able to tell where private equity has been buying up Maine businesses and which sectors they've been participating in?
So my colleagues are more of the market research. However, we did last year come out with, I don't know if you've seen it, but the Private Equity Risk Index, where you can sort of track in different sectors in your state where private equity has a large footprint or maybe not a large footprint. When I was looking at Maine, I was happy to see that, there's not as large of a private equity presence, for instance, in jobs or housing. I don't know if we were able to get the information. It looks like I'm looking at the page now. So I don't think we were able to get information for healthcare. And then also looking at pensions, how much the pension is invested in private equity. These sort of larger statistics, I mean, my colleagues, we have a hospital tracker with the healthcare team. So they're able to look at hospitals in each state. We were able to get the real estate information from a different source. And so, that's sort of a larger picture. But I think, which you'll probably more interested in and also which probably is more impactful research is, specific within those sectors, right? So nursing homes, hospitals, home healthcare and hospice is where we see a lot of private equity activity now. Looking to see it in those individual, I guess, subsectors where private equity activity is happening.
Hospices,
yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in a certain way, I mean, the other place that I've heard this is active in Maine is in prisons and in medical services provided to prisons. These are like people who have no place else to go. And I think that's a little bit the story with the mobile home parks that I want to talk about and bring Pat and Tracy into the conversation on that. But I mean, these are people who have no recourse.
Yeah, I don't want to delay us from getting into the Maine specific discussion because I think it's really important. But I think you've hit on a really important point here, which is that oftentimes private equity firms really direct their energy towards businesses that target poor working class people. Like you said, mobile homes, for-profit colleges, and so forth. And prison services are one of them. There are any number of, pretty distressing stories of private equity firms buying up the healthcare services for prisons. And, you have extreme stories of, for instance, a woman who had to give birth by herself in a cell. Another case where I believe that there was an entire hepatitis C outbreak, I believe in Maine, because of an alleged drug shortage caused by a private equity owned supplier. So it's one of those areas where oftentimes the services can get really bad because you have this literally captive audience that doesn't have an alternative.
So, Pat, I think this is a good time to bring you into the conversation, Pat Schwebler. You were involved in a circumstance in Maine regarding a mobile home park. Why don't you tell your story?
Okay. Well, Tracy Gear was wonderful enough to sponsor a bill, and we called the Opportunity to Purchase Bill. And had she not sponsored that last year, 2023, actually, and had it not passed, I wouldn't even be here with you today. So because of that bill, now people that live in, we call them manufactured home parks, what you refer to as mobile home parks, they now legally must get a notice from the seller. Prior to this law passing, the notice states your community is coming up for sale. If they happen to have an offer, here's what the offer is. And by new Maine law, you have 60 days to organize and come together if you choose to do so, to put in a competitive offer. So because of this law in 2024, myself and my colleague, I believe we organized, I want to say, in 9 different communities here in Maine. We were fortunate with Lynn Haven, now known as the Blueberry Fields Cooperative in Brunswick, Maine, that the seller did accept the offer, even though there was a competing offer. And the community moved forward. They were able to close in October of 2024. And because of that closing, 277 homes are preserved forever as affordable.
Okay, and so tell what happened here. So there was Lynn Haven, right? That had been owned by a family for a long time.
Yeah,
Okay, so then what happened? Somebody came out of the blue and offered to buy them out, or?
Correct. So they were notified. They reached out to CDI, Cooperative Development Institute.
Okay, so wait a minute, but that offer, do we know that was a private equity firm that was offering to buy this out, or?
We do not know, and the law does not point to having to reveal who the other buyer is. So we have no way of knowing that.
Okay, so it was an anonymous buyer that came out of nowhere and offered to buy out this family business.
Correct.
Okay, and then what happened?
So we worked with them for about 10 months, and the community took all the information we had to offer. We had many, many meetings, and democratically, they formed a cooperative, they incorporated, and the net-net in our cooperative model is every household has one vote democratically. So they came together and voted to proceed and purchase their community. So, and I will share with you today, and right now as I speak, the second community is closing in Bangor, Maine right now. They're at the closing table. That was the second community where the owner of the property did agree to sell to the residents. And once that closes, that's another 130 households with the capability to add about 70 more households.
So these are two that had sort of a happy ending, but how did these go wrong when private equity is the buyer?
Well, to give you the flip side of it, we also organized in Lewiston, Maine with two communities that were being sold as a portfolio by a family in Maine that owned them. And unfortunately, that was the other result. Residents did want to move forward, did present an offer, but the seller sold to Boa Vida, who I believe falls in your description of private equity. So Boa Vida now owns those two communities, and they own a few more here in Maine, but they have a presence throughout the U.S. So that is the situation where it didn't end as we were all hoping it would.
So Brendan, I you know, your book talked a little bit about these. How does the private equity business model work out for people in those communities?
Yeah, for folks in manufactured housing, it can often be a very tough situation. So there was great reporting on when Carlyle bought up a mobile home park in California. They rapidly increased lot rents for the mobile home residents. And just to lay out the basics, how these the business model works here. So typically, folks own the physical structure of the manufactured home, but then have to pay a lot rent every month or whatever it happens to be to the owner of the park. By dramatically increasing the lot rents, Carlyle not only was taking away folks' income in terms of the money that they had to pay every month, but it made the homes themselves much less valuable because now it would be harder for other folks to move in, which, you know, slashed the not just the income of these residents, but the wealth as well. There was really very tough reporting, I believe, by the Los Angeles Times about exactly this story, describing how residents of this mobile home park or manufactured home park were literally collecting cans to try to avoid, a third hour with an attorney to give them guidance on things like that. So you just have a situation where the community is often dramatically outmatched relative to the buyers of these parks.
Tracy, how did this come to your attention?
Yeah, and so, Anne, I think Pat, when Pat and her colleagues brought the bill to me, I am a state legislator in Maine. This is my third term that I'm entering now. Prior to that, I had spent many years in the business world. So my background is, kind of in that world and understanding how companies operate. And two things I'd want to just say to start off is that I think one of the things that's difficult for folks, just your average people out there, to understand about this model is that people think about companies as organizations that make something or provide a service, and then they provide that to you, and then you pay them, and they are focused on satisfying you as the customer. And people think that way, that is what a business is. And I think the one of the most dramatic things that starts to come clear when you look at how the mobile home park industry is an example here, and the role of companies like private equity firms, is that is not what they do. They acquire businesses, they acquire what they would call portfolios of assets. They don't think of them as businesses, and they don't really even necessarily think of the end customer as their customer. Rather, their end customers are their investors. Their end customers are the people who have provided the money that was described earlier into their funds that they manage. And so that's who they're looking to satisfy. And the way that they look to satisfy that is to provide the greatest return on the investments that they've made. So if you take a step back and go back to the story that Pat told, when they brought that bill to me, I had started to really delve into what was happening in housing in Maine. And like every other state across the country, we have a dramatic housing shortage. We have what many refer to as a housing crisis, in which some of our lowest income folks are losing access to housing that they can afford. And so one of the best examples in our state of housing that is naturally affordable. So this means there's no government subsidy that is involved in creating or managing that property are mobile home parks. So very often they are a cottage mom and pop kind of business that has been in place for, hundreds of years, in some cases 70, 80 years. And that family has been invested in that business, and the owners are approaching retirement. So you just have a lot of older mobile home park owners. They're ready to get out of the business, and they start to look into selling it. And that is when firms like private equity firms and other potential investors look into buying these. And the other thing I wanted to tease out here that I think is really important is in this model, it is not a productive model. It is what I would call a rent-seeking model. And so in economics, you have something called rent-seeking, which is an investor will take a hold of a set of assets and manipulate those assets in order to maximize the return. And in this case, you have a situation in mobile home parks that is ripe for that kind of market manipulation. As has been referenced, you have people who are largely stuck. They're often elderly. They're often on very fixed incomes, oftentimes are facing some sort of disability. And in those situations, they have the one thing they own is their mobile home. They own the unit, but they do not own the land that it sits on. And so they, and in many cases, especially if they're older, the mobile homes themselves, they are difficult to move. In the case if they're rickety, they really can't be moved safely. And if they are, if you are able to move them to another park, it's typically going to cost $5,000 to $10,000 to do that. So these are folks who do not have access to that pot of money to move that to another alternative if their rents increase. So there you have a captive audience. Those folks can't move. The investor company can then come in and do what they want with the rents. And the folks are then trying to figure out how to pay. And there are, unfortunately, a number of mobile home parks before the law that Pat referenced went into play that have been purchased and where they have seen annual steep rent increases on the pads that they sit on. And so that really does put the residents in quite a fix.
You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Chris Noble, Policy Director at the Private Equity Stakeholder Project, Pat Schwebler, Co-Director of the Cooperative Development Institute's New England Resident-Owned Communities Program, Brendan Ballou, former federal prosecutor and special counsel for private equity at the U.S. Department of Justice. He's author of the book Plunder Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America, and the Honorable Tracy Geer, Maine State Representative from Kennebunkport, Chair of the Legislature's Housing and Economic Development Committee. We're having a conversation about private equity in Maine, private equity and you. This show was pre-recorded. Send your comments or questions to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. Brendan, I want to go back to you and ask you to talk a little bit about the way pension funds play into this. And, I guess I'm wondering, are those pension funds at enhanced risk if they're investing through private equity funds? Or is it just a matter of, like, just thinking about, a teacher's fund that, like, are they clear that they're investing in a sort of a rapacious capitalism scheme that's really undermining the fabric of their community? I mean, what is the color of that transaction? Yeah.
It's a great question. So a couple of things. One is, as we were talking about with Chris earlier on, pension funds are really one of the primary ways that private equity firms get the money that they need to buy up businesses. Some pension funds, I think, are more aware of sort of the challenges of private equity than others. And I think one sort of note of hope here is that pension funds can be terrifically valuable or powerful in shaping the direction that private equity firms go in. Pension funds in Minnesota, for instance, were instrumental in really making prison phone services less attractive as a target acquisition for private equity firms.
Well, you have to explain how those were taking advantage of people, those telephone services.
Of course. So to back up a second. So in prisons, many, if not most, phones are not actually operated by the prison. They're operated by a handful of private companies. And so when a prisoner wants to make a call to their family or vice versa, they often have to pay these companies. And these companies historically have charged exorbitant fees to do so. I think it's sometimes as much as $20 for a 15-minute phone call, when prisoners themselves might be making well under a dollar an hour for their jobs in the prison. So this is obviously a very contentious business to be in. At least one of the Minnesota state pension funds said that they were going to withhold investment in one private equity fund, I believe, until either they divested from the prison phone company or at least changed their operations. I can't remember the specifics of that. All of which is to say that pension funds really can be influential in shaping the work that private equity firms do. But to get to, I think, what is implicit or part of your question in terms of private equity funds' sort of importance to pension funds, I think pension funds tend to invest in private equity on the assumption that it is a better rate of return than investing in the stock market, you know, just buying an index fund or whatever it happens to be. There is a really interesting body of research suggesting that that might not actually be the case. Once you factor in all the fees that private equity firms get, you might not actually make any more money than just, you know, investing in an ordinary stock. I talked with a friend or an acquaintance who works adjacent to the industry about, well, that's the case. Why are pension funds still investing so much of their money in private equity? And he said that at some level, it's a little bit of fear about getting ahead of the herd on some of these things, that they don't want, you know, pension fund managers don't want to be the one to underinvest in private equity and get a subpar return as a result. So I think that there's hopefully going to be a little bit more critical thinking about whether private equity investments really are the smart investment that pension funds have historically considered them to be.
I mean, it's just interesting to think about whether main pension funds are investing in private equity that is responsible for the circumstance that Pat described with these manufactured home parks, which are, you know, really not great for our citizenry or our community. I see you nodding, Pat. Go ahead and weigh in if you want to.
No, I have that same thought. You know, where are those dollars going? And what is the extent of the people investing? What is their knowledge around that? And what about the participants? If I was a teacher, I would want to know exactly where my investment dollar is going. And of course, I'd want to truly support the people of Maine.
Mm-hmm. Chris, I mean, this brings us back to the question, like, how can people find out, like, if you're one of those teachers whose pension fund is invested in some of those private equity firms, can you tell whether they're doing harm in your own community, or is it hard to find out?
Well, there's so much to be said about so many things raised after sort of talking about pension funds in terms of the relationship. That I could say more, but in terms of, you know, folks being able to, and I see it as being able to look at your, you know, 401k and stuff like that, right? Like that stuff is there for you to see. Similarly, some states or most states, you know, allow for like public comment participation in some way, but it's limited. I guess, honestly, this is really a distinction, not a similarity. Because oftentimes, like the private equity firm, asset manager, makes it difficult for the investment team on the pension fund to even sort of get an idea of, you know, fees relative to investment performance and that kind of deal. And then the trustees are even a level removed from that, right? And so then where does that leave the general public? One of the things that we found, and we would work with other organizations on releasing a report on private equity lobbying in the housing industry. And so, I guess more broadly, corporate landlord lobbying. And there are all these trade associations that firms funnel money to. And that money, right, part of that money at least comes from the, you know, returns they get from investments, and to invest in that, they get that money from pension funds. And so to your point, Anne, you could have a situation conceptually where there's a teacher who's looking for a place to live in their own community where they work, and they can't find a place, yet their retirement money is going to fund a private equity firm that is partially using part of that money to lobby against rental cap. And so there's a perverse sort of circle that folks can see, you know, here that does stretch to the general public, because again, we're talking about public employees' money. They have no say, you know, how they invest. So. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to talk about a few more examples that may or may not be happening in Maine to give people sort of a colorful picture of how this works. For example, and I don't know if any of you can comment on this, I've heard that a lot of veterinary clinics in Maine have been bought out by private equity. Is that true elsewhere? And how does that play out?
I guess I can take this. Speaking nationally, veterinary clinics have been very attractive targets for private equity firms. You know, one of the standard tactics that a private equity firm will engage in is what's called a roll-up. So trying to buy many businesses in a specific industry and geography with the hope of, you know, on the one hand, getting more operational efficiencies, but on the other hand, getting market power through which you can raise prices and lower costs, or lower quality of care, I should say. Private equity got very interested in veterinary care, in part because there were so many solo practitioners or small group practitioners, which made for an easy roll-up. And I'll also say, because these are small businesses, the acquisitions don't trigger the reporting requirements to the FTC and Department of Justice that would typically make the antitrust enforcement agencies aware that these roll-ups are occurring. So in some ways, these sorts of roll-ups are harder to track and harder to stop than acquisitions of very large companies.
So, I mean, just hypothetically, like, I don't know this, but let's say one firm could own 60 or 70% of the veterinary clinics in Maine, and we might not know.
It's entirely possible, or at least at the very least, one firm could buy all of them up and they would never have to report any individual acquisition to the enforcement authorities.
Yeah. Yeah. What are some other examples? I think we all sort of heard about the Stewart Hospitals in the Boston area. That was a private equity situation, wasn't it? But we don't really have Maine hospitals owned by private equity, to my knowledge. Do you know, Chris?
I mean, from what I can look at the risk index and sort of remember, you know, putting the information together, I do think we got stuck on Maine because, you know, there's a dearth of private equity in terms of hospitals. But, you know, I'm not sure about other sectors. But yeah,
like nursing homes or hospice might be
right,
other ones.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we don't have any numbers for hospice. But yeah, I looks like there's a bit of a data gap for nursing homes. It looks like we were able to find numbers. I think it's like almost 13% of private equity or of nursing homes in Maine owned by private equity. But still, you know, there are states that have higher percentages. So
why are we talking about this on a democracy show? Would anybody like to take a crack at that? Like, why is this a problem for democracy? Brendan, I'm going to give you the first shot, I guess.
Sure. Well, you know, I think it's implicit in one of the answers that Chris gave about lobbying in the housing industry. You know, concentrated financial power pretty directly translates into concentrated political power. So you have examples of, you know, housing is a great example where, you know, Blackstone bought up a ton of single family rentals in California and then spent millions of dollars successfully lobbying to prevent tenant protections from being extended to those single family homes. So I think you see that in all sorts of ways. And I think you see it in our political system today to a certain extent. You know, you have, you know, the last three, except for the most recent Treasury secretaries, all went to private equity. You've got two secretaries of, or speakers of the House, various secretaries of state, defense, chair people of the SEC and FCC. It's a very deep bench of folks that are now working on behalf of the industry. And as a result, I think the industry has been astoundingly successful at achieving its legislative objectives.
Do you feel this in your committee, Tracy, the lobbying?
I was going to just jump in on this one and say, you know, I think that from my perspective, when we're looking at all of these issues in Maine specifically, because we are kind of a small market, we have 1.4 million people in the entire state, as I pointed out on several occasions in many of the places in committee and many of the places that have been mentioned here, you know, one city might be the size of our entire state. And that is also very, very large and spread out geographically. And so the impacts of, you know, individual purchases, first of all, all aren't often known because the connections are slim between parts of the state. But also, it's just sort of not a big enough, target to go after, as you would see if you did this in Texas or Pennsylvania or something, where you just have a much larger concentration of business and people. And so I think that one of the things that I'm constantly doing in looking at housing specifically is looking at other areas where what we've seen happen in the mobile home park field is happening, if that's happening elsewhere. I will say that to Chris's point, there is difficulty in understanding what's actually happening in the market because so many of these entities are mom and pop. We have a lot of mom and pop landlords generally, that sort of thing. So it really does, it really is incumbent upon us as legislators and policymakers to try to keep track of where this might be happening and to get out in front of it from, the main statutes. And I think what we did in the case of the mobile home parks was we did what we could, right? We require notification. So not only do the residents need to be notified, but a notification also has to go to our state housing authority at that moment. So rather than these transactions happening under the covers, they're happening in a way that the people who work in this area know about them in advance of them happening. And that it enables us to have, make sure that organizations like Pat's organization, the Cooperative Development Institute, and others know to reach out to the folks and say, hey, we can help you organize and we can help you take charge of your destiny if you are interested in doing that and putting in the work to do it. And so I think, as we look at elsewhere in housing, looking at multifamily housing more generally in Maine, trying to keep an eye on what's happening in the single family housing world. And then increasingly, as we strive in my committee to work to build the additional housing that Maine needs at all income levels, but definitely for our lower and middle income households, that we'll be, having our eyes out for that and making sure that we're empowering folks to get ahead of the trend if we can.
You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Brendan Belew, author of the book Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America, the Honorable Tracy Geer, you just heard from, Maine State Representative from Kennebunkport, Chair of the Legislature's Housing and Economic Development Committee, Chris Noble, who's Policy Director at the Private Equity Stakeholder Project, and Pat Schwebler, Co-Director of the Cooperative Development Institute's New England Resident-Owned Communities Program. We're talking today about private equity and you. This program was pre-recorded on February 18th. No listener calls are being taken. So how do we protect ourselves? I mean, what measures can states, let's just say for the moment that we will not be able to rely much on the federal government to protect us, what can states do to enact their own protections to protect their people from the worst outcomes? Brendan, your book listed a few ideas. Maybe I'll ask you to kick us off.
Sure, I can kick it off. I'm very curious to hear what Chris and Tracy and Pat have to say on this. So, at Corey, we were talking about the basic problems with the private equity business model. Short-term thinking, reliance on debt and fees, insulation from liability. I think that there could be state legislation to try to restrain or constrain some of those tendencies. In particular, what I think would be really helpful is if there were state legislation to say, in essence, private equity firms can engage in leveraged buyouts in our state, but if that leverage buyout results in essentially a disaster, widespread layoffs, injury to customers or to employees, needless bankruptcy as a result of over-leveraging the business, that's okay, but we're going to make sure that the private equity firm that may not be the technical owner but is the decision maker in this circumstance is held financially responsible for those consequences. The basic problem that we've got is that private equity firms can often make decisions on behalf of businesses, but not be held financially responsible for those decisions. And if you can change that, and I think that change can happen at the state level, I think you'll see private equity firms behaving much, much more responsibly.
I see you nodding, Chris. Do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many part of my position at private equity stakeholder project is tracking all of the mini state bills on every aspect of private equity that people are trying to address. So there is, just let me get that out of the way, a lot of different ways that states are trying to address private equity. Brendan talked about, private equity firms being on the hook when their portfolio companies face liability. I think that's great. And there are some solutions like that that are directly addressing private equity, but there are also some that also will capture, it's not just a specific private equity bill, but they might, address corporate landlord housing consolidation, right? They could address hospital mergers and review and give the AG in each state, more third authority to review potential transactions. But even stuff like rental caps, is tied to, it relates to private equity, addressing private equity, because as we were talking about landlords, charging exorbitant rent, whether it be manufactured housing parks, or what have you, we see a lot of private equity, corporate landlords doing that. And so there's that, but I also want to talk about just a larger sort of if I can wax philosophic for a second, what we're really talking about in terms of private equity practices are inherently undemocratic. When it comes to lack of transparency, when it comes to them not being on the hook for the actions they do, when it comes to mass layoffs and not having skin in the game, these are things that I think are on full display right now. We're talking about this democratic moment where folks are shocked and they see these practices happening at the federal government. But folks have to know that these folks that act this way or think that they can run the country this way have had practice, right? They've had practice with portfolio companies. They've had practice laying people off. And if we're to have a society that reflects democratic values, we also have to start talking about stuff like democratizing the workplace, right? Or consumer co-ops like Pat, right, helped start. And so, we have to have a real conversation that this ideology of, the country should be a business. I've heard people say it before. Any good business should be. Well, that's not the bottom line of a country or a society. It's a public good, right? That is not part of the fiduciary duty logic. And so let's address the sort of inherent anti-democratic, notions there.
That's well said. Tracy, do you want to weigh in? I'm sorry. I surprised
you.
Yeah,
I'm actually.
What states can do?
I'm very eager to follow up on some of the publications that have been mentioned here by the other panelists. And I think for me, one of the things that has struck me just looking at housing and the impacts that these trends have had is really we've never in our country really looked at housing and homes as something separate, right? The idea that taking something that has been, where we all live, in whether it's a house or an apartment building or whatever, and saying that's just an asset to be manipulated by someone to try to make money. That has just been very striking over the last number of years I've been working in this area. So I think that is a big question that as a democracy, we should really be dealing with, which is, should these practices be allowed when it comes to actual homes and housing? And so I think that's something that it might be bigger than a state can handle, because I think you run into some of the federal laws in this area. But it is something that I think we're going to be confronting. And then lastly, one of the things we're doing in the short term, trying to make these targets of these asset plays less attractive. I mean, the idea, if we can make it more complicated and less, easy for these folks to take over mobile home parks and drive people out of their homes and drive their rents to unsustainable levels, which is where we are with many of those that have already been purchased in these scenarios. Hopefully it will happen less in the short term.
You want to just answer that question quickly, Pat, what states can do? I know you're actually doing something. So,
yeah. And, what Tracy said about making it unattractive, our residents are making it unattractive. The two big parks in Old Orchard that unfortunately wanted to move forward, but private equity intervened, a large company from California, those residents organized. They formed a tenant organization. They went to their town, used their democratic voice, and put on the ballot a rent restriction for mobile home parks that passed. So that private equity player is not happy. So we have to remember, as tentative as everything is today, we do still have a voice and we do have to come together. And that starts with community. So,
all right, we're running out of time this afternoon. Great conversation. I want to give you each a moment to throw in a parting thought, but you've just got like a minute. So, Pat, back to you. Parting thought, final wrap up.
Keeping homes in people's hands is so important. It builds community. They invest in their community. They volunteer. They become active participants. To have a conglomerate own your home, there's not that buy-in. There's not that care. So that's my parting thought. Thank you.
Tracy, very quickly, parting thought.
Yeah, I think we do have a great opportunity to have folks take charge of situations where they have been taken advantage of. And I think we will be working in the Maine legislature to help people do that.
Chris, what would you like to say?
I got my thought out last time, but no, you know, I think really, you know, what we're talking about is trying to make sure folks can, you know, have the ability to take their life in their own hands still. And when we're talking about housing and healthcare, these are not, you know, going to buy an iPod or something that you don't need. iPhone, right? Anything like that. It is something that folks need. We talk about captive audiences. And so, you know, to have a functioning democracy in society, we have to restore folks' ability to you know, to enjoy life with these basic things that are not, you know, hampered, you know, by companies like private equity firms. So that's my parting thought. Thank you.
Okay, Brendan, last word to you.
Just very briefly, this is a really encouraging conversation for me to see the work that, you know, Chris and I have talked before, so I know all the great work that the Private Equity Stakeholder Project is doing, but to see what's happening at a state level that Tracy and Pat are engaged in, change is going to happen at the local level here, and it already is happening at some level in Maine, and that's very encouraging.
Thank you all so much. Links to some of the resources that were mentioned in this conversation today are on our website, lwvme.org. I want to thank you to our guests this afternoon for a great conversation. Brendan Ballou, former federal prosecutor and special counsel for private equity at the U.S. Department of Justice. He's author of the book, Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. We had with us also the Honorable Tracy Geer, Maine State Representative from Kennebunkport, Chair of the Legislature's Housing and Economic Development Committee. Chris Noble, who's the policy director of the Private Equity Stakeholder Project, and Pat Schwebler, co-director of the Cooperative Development Institute's New England Resident-Owned Communities Program. You've been listening to the Democracy Forum, a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM, streaming at weru.org. If you have a comment about this show, send it to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. The League of Women Voters website is lwvme.org for more information about this topic or to learn about other shows in this series. As I mentioned, links to some of the resources that were mentioned today, including the Risk Index, are on that website. You can subscribe to our podcast at lwvme.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next month.